everybody. Welcome to Inside Geocaching HQ. I'm Chris Ronan. My username is RockChalk. I am one of the 80 or so people who works at Geocaching HQ in Seattle. Thank you for downloading our podcast. This is our first episode of 2018. Hope your year is off to a good start. Hope you were able to attend one of the Australia Day geocaching events a few weeks ago. There's a lot more neat stuff coming up on the geocaching calendar as the year rolls on. And as the year continues, we would really like to hear from you about what we should cover on the podcast. What questions do you have? What topics would you like us to dive into? Please email us. The address is podcast@geocaching.com. That is podcast@geocaching.com. You can pause this right now. You can go to your computer or open up your smartphone. You can send me an email, podcast@geocaching.com. I'll wait while you pause and while you send your email. And then when you're done, come back and we will continue. Whatever your question, I will do my best to find the right person to answer it. Okay, in this episode, we will hear from one of the longest tenured employees at Geocaching HQ. Sean Boots started here way back in 2004. You are certainly aware of his work, whether you realize it or not. He has done quite a few things in 14 years here that impact how we search for geocaches and how we play the game. He's a very interesting person. I think you'll enjoy hearing his story. So, here is me talking with Sean Boots. Okay, so let's just start with what's your title and what's a, just in a nutshell, what you do at HQ every day.
Cool. I am the manager for the web development team, basically. That does not constitute mobile. It doesn't constitute IT. It's a bunch of 15 people, I think, is what we have now. And it's the front end developers. It's the middle and back end developers of the company.
So it's the people that work on the website as opposed to working on the mobile apps. Is that
yes,
generally
but also,
speaking?
But yeah, mostly it's the web all inclusive, but also the API and all of the services under the covers. So we kind of provide the business logic for the web and the mobile applications. But we also do the web stuff themselves. We also do some internal tools, and you know we're responsible for PagerDuty, and we're the ones who, when things go wrong on the website, it's us and IT who come to the rescue.
So this is 14 years, is that right?
I'm coming up on 14 years. August. It's been 14 years. It's amazing. And we've gone through so many different iterations. I think this is my fourth building. So that's, we started in a little dinky building downtown Seattle. It was before Amazon had sort of taken over that whole area. There was a Whole Foods that it was like a hole in the ground. And it actually like was being built in front of us as we were in that building. And there were seven of us, I think, when I started. So we ended up staying in that building for a couple of years. And I think there's only like two people other than me, three people total that are still actively working here. It's changed a lot since then. Yeah, and we moved to downtown, and then we moved to this area, and there are two different buildings in this area. So we've been there since.
And so to give some perspective, seven people then, and now it's around 75 or 80. So it's grown by about 10 times. That's pretty amazing.
It's crazy, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because when I first started, I was very green. I was hired to basically supplement work that Jeremy was doing. I was the first developer other than him. They had a couple other people do that job and then they had already left. And so from my perspective, I was being hired to supplement Jeremy.
And Jeremy being, for people that don't know, Jeremy Irish.
One
of the co-founders of the company.
The Ray Kroc of geocaching. Yeah.
I wonder if anybody's ever called him that.
Well, I have. I have done it for years.
I could see Michael Keaton playing Jeremy in a movie.
I think that'd be awesome.
The founders. Yeah.
They look just like each other. Yeah.
Who would play Brian? I don't know who would.
That's a good question. Probably
that one through, like
Robert Downey Jr.
Like a young
Robert Downey Jr.
Oh, yeah. I like that.
Al Pacino might be a little old at this
that's
point.
That's true. That's why I say, yeah, I was thinking like Al Pacino in The Godfather could play Brian. But
that's it.
But no, I like the Downey Jr. idea. So, okay, so you're doing that work, supplementing some of Jeremy's work. So going back to then, 2004, what were you doing at that time, and how did geocaching kind of come into your life? How did this opportunity come to you originally?
I mean, so when I joined, I think I was in the 200,000th of users or something like that. So like my account is, you know, and I started right as I created my account, basically. And we weren't talking about millions of people. We were talking hundreds of thousands. And it was just kind of starting to blow up. And I was really green. It was my first coding job. I had worked for my father for 10 years as a warehouse manager prior to that. And I was a self-taught coder who was looking to be, I just wanted to get into that industry. And so I tried really, you know, I made a bunch of websites, you know, and this is also the web is just getting started. And so, you know, just trying to find contracting gigs with whoever I could find. You know, my father's company had a customer. I would ask them if they needed a website and then I would do it. When I finally decided that I was a good enough programmer, I decided I was going to spread my wings and I was going to like try to get a job somewhere else. And I put my resume on monster.com just to sit there. I had no intention of like promoting it or actively doing anything about it. I just wanted to see what would happen if I did it. And so I put all these gigs that I'd done and I had this skill that I have now. And I swear it was like within a week, I get an email from Jeremy and he's like, "Hey, it looks like you have a skill set that's similar to what we're looking for. Can I call you?" I'm like, yeah, absolutely. That would be kind of cool. I mean, he's like, yeah. So he calls me, like literally after I sent the email back, he calls me.
And did you know about geocaching?
I had never heard of it. So that was actually that moment was my introduction to geocaching. And it was really, that was like, hey, this thing exists and there's an actual job waiting that I could possibly, it was kind of interesting. So of course he asked me a few questions, like wanted to know what my skill set was. And it was basically like he and I did the same kind of thing. And so it was like a good fit. So he invited me to come in for an interview. And then, of course, I did the whole due diligence. Let me go and geocache and figure out what this is about. I'm going to find my first cache and I'm going to learn, you know, I'm going to be prepared. And so then I was able to go into the interview and we kind of just like had a couple of ad hoc conversations about like, so you do this technology and this technology. And I'm like, yeah. He's like, okay, cool. So I hear you're in a band, or I, you know, like just do I like you kind of time
right,
talk.
Right.
And so,
okay. So you talk to Jeremy, he kind of explains what he's looking for and
right. So he offered me the job after that conversation. All right, this is a good fit. And so went home, he calls me, we got a position for you. And so then it was kind of like, how do I tell my dad?
Right.
Because
you've been there for like 10 years, you said, right?
Ten years. Wow. And I know, and I mean, in hindsight, he was like, why are you still here? Like, will you just go get a job, please?
So I opened up the Internet Wayback Machine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is awesome.
And a look at, and maybe I'll post this on the podcast page, but if I don't, people can go and look at the Internet Wayback Machine and just put in geocaching.com and look in 2004. And so this is what the website would have looked like when you first showed up here. And
this is exactly what it looked like. I mean, there's no denying. Is this exactly what it looked like? Yeah,
what comes to your mind when you see this now?
My first thought is that, well, we've come a long way and that we're, you know, despite I still have like misgivings about where we are, I want to keep moving us forward and getting better and making us look prettier and be in a better place. But, you know, you sometimes you forget like where you came from a little bit. So this is kind of exciting to see that, man, we are way, it's way, way better now. Yeah. So it also reminds me that I actually didn't work on the geocaching website in my early part of my career. Like actually the first thing I did was put a geocaching search functionality into REI kiosks, which for me was really exciting to work with a big partner and do something kind of neat in a visible arena, you know? And so that was really fun and exciting, a good first project. But ultimately, my job was to figure out with Jeremy a solution for virtual caches and locationless caches, which were causing like enormous problems on the website. People were placing really terrible virtual caches and exploiting that concept, and we weren't getting very good quality, and reviewers were ready to revolt. The locationless concept was a great idea, but it was implemented incorrectly because it treated like basically like geocache type locations were basically being created in the logs, and then there was no way to log the logs, and so it just was a mismatch, despite it being a really cool idea. And so Jeremy and I, it wasn't just Jeremy and I, but like the whole group at the time, Nate and Brian and all the people, you know, Elias, all of us were talking about what could we do, what's a good idea, how can we fix this whole problem, and ultimately the idea of waymarking came about, which was to take these locationless caches and create their own website. So categories would become the cache, and then the logs would actually be on the same level as caches. And then we would actually be able to log the logs at that point. So you'd be able to log the waymarks. But anyways, for many years, probably 5 years, that was my core responsibility, was to build the waymarking site from scratch, and to, you know, add features and keep it maintained and try to get it into a better, bigger place. I mean, Nate and I, you know, Nate was kind of like the product manager for that project, and I was the sole developer, and we sort of like hashed ideas out together, and we pushed features as fast as we could. The community of locationless owners was the root of the beginnings for that site. We asked them all to create categories, and we gave them this new site to, and they all seeded this website with all their locationless caches. Anyhow, so the waymarking was my primary job, and at some point we sort of as a company made a decision that we really wanted to focus deeper on the core offering. So geocaching was our bread and butter. It was the piece. It was the place where community was continuing to develop at a great pace. Waymarking was still doing well, but not nearly at the same level as the geocaching. And so we sort of made a decision that we needed to put all our resources on geocaching. And so that's when I started being tasked with doing things for the geocaching site instead of the waymarking site. And for a long time, we tried to build things in the engineering department that would work with both. So like you build one thing for geocaching and then waymarking could kind of piggyback off of it. But at some point we ended up building this monolithic website that it's basically a solution of code that is, we jokingly call it Tucson. It's just the all of the geocaching website, all of the waymarking website, all of everything that we ever did was just put into this big place, and it got to be unwieldy, and it became hard to move in any kind of pace, and we decided eventually that we should start splitting those things out into their own projects. And so waymarking eventually was pulled out and geocaching was left, and that ended up being where most of the effort was going. And, you know, ever since then, we've been progressively getting more professional and just improving all of the performance of that site and the look of it and all that kind of
thing. So as the years have progressed and you have worked your way through various positions, and what are some of the things, you talked about waymarking, some of the other stuff that kind of some of the highlights for you over the time that you've been here?
We've done some major, I mean, there's been really, really great and terrible things that have happened throughout those years. Waymarking, I would argue, is a highlight for me. I mean, I'm actually proud of the work that was done with that. I actually think it's still a viable idea, and I think it has possibility. So from my perspective, that is still a source of pride. We've built full search functionality under the covers. We have separated our accounts and our payment into services. We're currently making large strides with the maps. We had already made large strides with the maps compared to what it had been in the beginning. Warrego was a huge experiment. That actually was the thing that was like the secret project when I was first hired. Like, it's the killer idea. We're gonna do awesome stuff with this. To this date, I think that idea is an amazingly good idea, and I think, you know, it's probably something that we're, you know, not done with, but it's something that we would, you know, we have to really think about it. And another moment of huge success for us was when we embraced the mobile world. The iPhone came out. I kind of have a story about that, because one of the guy that there was a guy that worked as our front desk person. He was very, very eager to get the new iPhone when it came out and the announcement came out, and you know, it was going to cost $600 for a phone, which seemed like insanity. And I remember myself talking with one of the other developers about, there's no way I'll pay this much for a phone. There's just no way. I just don't see it. Like, I've got my Sony Walkman phone. That's all I need. You know, I mean, come on. I just plug a headset in and I got my music here, you know. It's pretty awesome. But anyhow, I think obviously the iPod had already been out. But when the iPhone came out, it was like this obviously, you know, life-changing, grand change of how society works. And many of us were just kind of like rolling our eyes at it, thinking it was like, oh, here we go, another thing. But this guy, and I also Jeremy, I give Jeremy, he was in on it too, but they saw it immediately. And basically immediately pivoted the company towards, like, we got to get going on this because pocket PCs are not cutting the mustard for this. We're going to start building a mobile app. We're going to start hiring API developers. We're going to start, you know, doing this. And so, you know, Jeremy, I got to give him a lot of credit. And, you know, I wasn't in any kind of senior management position at the time. So I honestly don't know if it was all Jeremy or if it was, you know, I don't know who was responsible for those decisions at the time, but I always attributed it to Jeremy just because, like, having the foresight to get on that quickly and move that forward was a really good thing.
You've mentioned API a couple of times, and for people that I don't think I understood it very well at all before I came to work here, just as a geocacher, I heard the term, but I wasn't a software guy, so I didn't. So for people that might not know what API is, could you just give a brief summary so people might have a little bit better understanding that might not know what it is?
Sure. Sorry. API is the name is application programming interface. It's basically a way to connect an application like a website or an app to underlying functionality. So we would basically build this underlying business logic. So how the game is played, we present this to our mobile device, and then from outside of there, you know, in the world, that device will call the API, and that's how it has access to our data. Our website does the same thing internally. It'll actually call the APIs and get the data that way. And so the mobile and the web are sharing the same code and the same data underlying. And it actually is really nice because then you code one thing in one place and the rules apply to both places. And so we also have a partner program, which allows, it's currently on a kind of a on hold, but we have partners that we work with that are able to access our data similarly to our own devices and websites through this interface. We provide them with methods, log a geocache or get the geocache data or search for geocaches or, you know, whatever. But whatever we can provide for them, they would be able to like program their app such that they can call into our interface our data and use the data that, you know, so they can have an app experience that either enhances the geocaching, like something that GSAC might be doing, or it actually is a similar experience like what Cachely does. So both of those are using our APIs to run their businesses or whatever. Some people, and I will mention names like CGO, tend to use, they are not actually using our API. They're actually scraping our website. And a website can behave like an API in that you can access it in a similar way, and you can actually, you basically parse the data that's on each page and try to pull it down and aggregate it in your own way. And then you can represent that data a certain way. And so that's considered usually to be a kind of a rogue activity, but it's also a way that you can access data with less security measures. And so it's sort of a frowned upon thing, but some people do it, and it is a way, it's hard to get around people doing that, but it's a big job to actually do that because the data and the underlying website constantly changes. And so you're going to have to play kind of a whack-a-mole game. With the API, you're sort of ensured that the signatures, which are the, it's hard to explain, but the structure of the calls that you're going to make always remain that way. And if they change, you would get notified that we're making that change. So there's sort of a contract aspect to it where we get to decide what this contract is. You're going to agree to call it, and it's that in that form, and then we can move, you know, and you have an allotted amount of calls that you can make. You can't go too crazy or we will throttle you. The idea is that we create this place where we can partner with people, and then they would give us, you know, they will work with us to try to create a premium prop value that is consistent across the board. So the geocaching experience for somebody who uses Cachely and somebody who uses our app and somebody who uses GSAC is very similar. That's what the hope is. It doesn't always work like that in practice, but that's the goal, is to like make it more close to that. You know, when somebody like a CGO does it through scraping the website, it's a little bit harder to understand how they're using it. A lot of times they end up giving away features that are for free. And so, you know, things that people, premium members, are paying for us to provide these services for them. It's basically you're providing that, you know, you're making CGO be able to exist too, because they, you know, they're kind of riding on the backs of the premium members. So it's a little bit frustrating to have that kind of a situation happen. And, you know, we would love to have somebody like CGO actually use our API so that we would be a partner, as opposed to it's more of a parasitical or, you know, sort of a not necessarily symbiotic relationship. So there's we don't know how to solve that problem. And, you know, we understand that a lot of our community uses CGO, so it isn't necessarily in our interest to just shut them down, but it does constantly undermine our program with other well-meaning partners.
So outside of your work stuff, I noticed that last year was your best year for geocaching. You found, what I write down here, 134 caches last year. So what got into you last year? I got to know.
Well, I will say it's a little embarrassing that I haven't found more caches than I actually have, but that's part of the answer, is that I was moved into this job and I felt like I needed to take it seriously, and so I should learn the product a little better than I had. I also was inspired by a program that we have internally it's called a GeoGuide program. Kind of set up a series of like achievements and goals and incentives and rewards to help us to have a reason to go do stuff, you know, and so there's things like streaks, and which I got a 60 geocache streak last year, which I was pretty proud of, before I finally, I don't remember what it was that stopped me, but I think it was that I was starting to run out of places around my neighborhood, and I was finding myself in like supermarket parking lots at like 10:30 in the night. I'm like, I don't know if this is really what I'm doing for the next, you know, 6 months or whatever.
Geocaching has a fantastic community, people all over the world, and I know you've interacted with people all over the world, right? I mean, over the course of your many years here, is that something that you've enjoyed? You know, getting to meet people from different countries and getting to see how the game is played in different places?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to be able to travel to several different places. I've gone to Austria. There was a caching festival there, and it was Saalbach, Hinterglemm or something was the area, but it was amazing. It was a beautiful area. I got to go to Munich. I was able to see Salzburg. And so that just the geocaching in those areas was just really, really crazy. It's just so fun to see how it manifests elsewhere like this thing that we dreamt about when we were first starting this out, and to see it just like it's like a pox, a positive pox that it goes out and spreads across the globe, and then all of a sudden actually see it is so exciting to just, you know, I don't know. So it was really great. And so also I should mention that the treatment that a geocaching employee gets when you go to a mega event I sort of have a very tiny amount of experience with what the surface feeling of what it's like to be a rock star. I've been in a band and we had a modicum of success, but going to a geocaching mega event as a geocaching HQ employee is, for me, it felt more like being a rock star than being a rock star. You get put in front of, you know, 500 people to speak, you know, it's like, I didn't play for crowds like that ever. Like, I mean, and here I am put on the spot. They want to hear what I have to say about this game that I don't even play nearly like the way that they do. But because my experience is what it is, there's something that people are interested in there. And I mean, I just feel honored, I guess, that they treat us that kind of way, you know.
Well, I'm so glad you brought up being a rock star, because that was my last question for you. I've got to ask about
the Sean Boots music career, because it's kind of legend around here, but we don't hear the story as often as we should.
When I was a kid, I was like, you know, my parents got me into playing piano, and I got to be pretty interested in that, and I got into songwriting, and through my college years I wrote a whole bunch of songs and played with some kind of goofy cover bands and had, you know, a little bit of fun with it. But as I graduated, I ended up joining a band, and we called ourselves the Amateur Lovers, which is kind of hilarious because there is now a genre on the internet that Amateur Lovers is, and you probably don't want to look it up, but we had no idea. There was no internet when we started this band, so that name was purely by accident.
It's an awesome name, though.
I know. And the funny thing is, we didn't even start by... We were actually the Young Lovers was our original name, and we got sued by a band in Massachusetts called Young Love, and they gave us a cease and desist letter. And so we're like, ugh, what are we gonna do? What are we gonna call ourselves? And so then we had a song that was actually called Amateur Lover. And so I'm like, well, Amateur Lover song. It's like, there used to be a band that had an album called Living in a Box, and they had a song called Living in a Box, and their band name was Living in the Box. And so we're like, are we really going to do this? Like, we're going to be the Living in the Box, or our album's Amateur Lovers, song Amateur Lovers. Answer, no. So we took the name, we became Amateur Lovers, we changed the name of the song to something called like Grand Debut, and then we didn't name our album after that. But anyways, we had a little bit of a run where we you know, played in the Seattle post-grunge scene. We played around town, all the shows. We had good fortune to find, we got to hook up with a couple of really talented engineer friends that got us some free time at London Bridge Studio, and they helped us to make a record. And they got that record put in front of some people of importance that had abilities to make things happen, one of which was Stone Gossard of Pearl Jam. We ended up signing with his label, and then subsequently signing with a couple of labels in Australia and in Japan. So we had a worldwide distribution of our record, one record. And we were, you know, the kind of my heyday was to be basically, they sent us to Australia on a tour with Ben Folds Five, which at the time was my favorite band.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
It was just the most like dreamy, crazy. Yeah, it was crazy. And they were, you know, so they brought us along. We played four shows. We made a video, an old Boy Scout warehouse. MTV came and filmed the making of the video. I solved a Rubik's Cube on camera, which made me really proud of myself because I didn't think I was going to pull it off. But
oh my gosh.
So it was cool. But of course, they didn't use any of the footage. They only used footage of us telling the world how great Pearl Jam was. It's like, Pearl Jam has a new record. Let's check out what Amateur Lovers has to say about that. Oh, Stone Gossard is great.
I'm sure that helped Pearl Jam out a lot.
Yeah, it totally did. Well, more than it helped us out. But
so it's just the one album.
One album. There's a video you can find that's an embarrassing, like dated looking one. It's called Rubik's Cube. It's on YouTube.
But we're definitely putting that on the podcast page.
Oh gosh. To be honest, I'm proud of it. I actually think the lyrics are great. I love the message in it. It's pretty dated though. I mean, it's like it's literally 20 years old. I have long hair. I look kind of dorky, and I everybody makes fun of me at the end because I get all tough guy. And when it closes, it's so stupid. It's bad. It's an era bygone kind of, I mean, I had a clean cutoff. I quit the band when we lost our record deal. And like, there's a story when we were touring, like our last tour in California, I kind of had seen the writing on the wall. And I knew that I needed to think about what was going to be the next chapter. And so for me, it was it was about, basically, I had a feeling that coding was kind of going to be my thing because I had done that as a kid and I liked it. And so I was like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to learn how to do it. And so I'm sitting in the tour van reading a Visual Basic how-to instruction manual for pretty much the entire tour. Like, that was how I kept myself busy. And, you know, the guys in the band are like, why are you reading that book? Like, what does this mean? Like, are you like 1 foot out the door or whatever? And I didn't think I was at the time, but it turns out that I actually was. And so there was sort of like a segue right there of me having my two worlds sort of collide, and it was a clean break. I never really, I never went back. And so I haven't done anything musical ever since, other than a couple I've done actually, that's probably something to note, is that some of the songs, some of the background music in some of our geocaching videos is actually, it's me having done the music for that. So like, I don't know if you ever saw if anybody, you can go look it up, but the Cashers of Steel video, the underlying music is actually me, like in my studio at home. It's just, you know, instrumental music, but all the geocachers, like doing geocaching workout to it, like that was my thing. And then there was a how-to geocaching video also that I had done the music for. I kind of worked with Reed, our videographer. She would occasionally give me some gigs, I guess you could say. And so it was really, that was a cool way to take my personal interest and kind of merge it with my work interest. It was really fun. It's a lot of work though, so I don't know how much I'll be doing of that in the future, but it was cool to do back in those days.
Well, that's really cool. This has been really interesting. Thank you.
Cool. I had a really good time. I didn't realize I'd have so much to say. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So there you have it. Sean Boots, one of the longtime Geocaching HQ staffers. Hope you enjoyed that. I've said it before, I'll say it again. Let us know what you would like to hear about on the podcast by emailing us. podcast@geocaching.com is the address. That's podcast@geocaching.com. Or if you see me or one of my coworkers at a geocaching event, please share your podcast ideas with us there. Thanks again for listening. From all of us at Geocaching HQ, happy caching.